from the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the closing market report for the 28th day of March 2016. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's at Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. We'll hear from Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. I had a conversation with him Friday morning. And then we'll take up the agricultural cash grain markets, that with the folks at the Andersons from right here in Champaign County. As we close out our time together, we'll take a look at the agricultural weather forecast, too, with the guys up at Risk Pulse in Chicago on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report on this 28th day of March. It's a Monday afternoon. Kurt Kimmel from Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, joins us to talk about the trade and what's been taking place. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Well, good afternoon, Todd.
On Thursday of this week, the United States Department of Agriculture, the very last day of the month, will release the acreage and the grain stocks reports. Have they been calming the marketplace down? And then, of course, we probably ought to talk about wheat. And I saw the word or phrase, big shoulders, moved around the market a couple of times as it relates to that particular commodity.
Yeah, we saw some fairly aggressive buying of wheat throughout the trading session. Going to midday, the commodity funds were buyers of over 5,000 contracts of wheat. You know, a little concern about last week's frost freeze. And more importantly, the forecast for the southern plains, they kind of removed the moisture out of that, and that generated the fundamental catalyst to turn the green light on to be buyer. Also, too, the European trade was kind of absent, so they were off due to Easter Monday here, and you know, they hold a large portion of some of the world wheat stocks, and there wasn't that hedge pressure coming out of Europe, so it'll be quite interesting to see what tomorrow brings here, see if we can follow through. But technical-wise, you know, good strong 8 cent higher close. The key will be whether or not the wheat market can move, May wheat particularly, if we can move above the 480 level, close to those highs we made 2 weeks ago. But as you mentioned, the front and center will be Thursday, whether we get a big bullish or big bearish price reaction from the numbers. We're fixing to find out, I guess. The thing is, visiting with producers across the Midwest, they're all, I want to say, all in. You know, they're going to plant as long as the weather cooperates, and I think intentions are going to be high. I think the corn number is close to 90 million acres. I think the bean estimate, you know, is you know, close to 83 and a half million acres is strong until weather proves different here. But like we mentioned quite a bit in the meetings this winter, once we do have these acreage numbers out, and you plug those in the supply-demand balance sheet, at the top of the supply-demand balance sheet, the next most important factor that probably moves the bottom line, the carryout estimate the most, is the yield. So once we see the planting intentions estimate, we'll quickly shift to weather to see if those acres get in or not. Then we'll start adjusting a lot of the commentary to what type of yield they want to put on the crop as we go through the growing season.
So this Friday, this Thursday's reports will set the tone for what, a couple of months at least, I suppose, unless the weather is really takes a front and center kind of run in the marketplace. And then we get into the weather markets of late May, June, July, when both the corn and the soybean, and August that is, might be made or broken at that point. What are you telling producers that they ought to do in this case? Wait it out until Thursday and then make some decisions about where they stand?
Well, that's a good question, and that could the answer to that could probably go on for 2 or 3 hours on what to do. Each one's a little different, and we found that you know, a lot of producers have a lot of different goals and objectives and have done a lot of different marketing things. But as far as old crop goes, we've been promoting the idea to go ahead and push that out the door, generate some working capital, and do some cash replacements because your leverage is a lot stronger. You've got some cash flow to operate on, but you still retain some ownership. option premiums. It's kind of the low end of the volatility scale, so there's some pretty good buys there. As far as new crop, there's nothing wrong with, we've recommended moving some cash beans whenever November futures traded 925. We got up to 926. I know basis is wide on the new crop. If you're uncomfortable making those cash sales, you can do some type of downside protection hedge on that. As far as corn, we're going to sit tight here just a minute and see if we can't get up into back into the 395, 398 area as a goal here on some hopefully month end in the quarter short covering to push the market up there. The funds have covered quite a bit of their short position. As of last week there, they're only short about 67,000 contracts of corn. At one time, they were short, almost over 200,000.
Hey, thanks so much. I appreciate you being with us for the day.
Very good. Take care, Todd.
You too. Kurt Kimmel is with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Joins us here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're joined now by the United States Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for being with us today. Let's get started with this series of questions. The first one is on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Will this trade pact be passed by Congress? And if so, can that be done before the November presidential elections?
Well, I think it's extremely important that we get the Trans-Pacific Partnership passed through Congress and approved and ratified through the process this year. There are many reasons for that, but for agriculture, it's about increasing market opportunities in Asia, which is a fast-growing market, particularly for our high-value products. We're going to see significant tariff reduction and elimination on American agricultural products. Farm Bureau has proposed and suggested and studied this, and they believe it will increase exports by over $5 billion and increase farm income by over $4 billion, all of which I think is extremely important, especially with commodity prices where they are today. So it is important for American agriculture. I think it's also important for the country because it essentially allows the United States to lead an effort at a high standards agreement that includes labor and environment protections. That speaks about biotechnology and organics, that contains a science-based and a commitment to a science-based rulemaking system for sanitary and phytosanitary purposes. So this is just extremely important, and it will allow us to balance the Chinese influence in Asia. We don't really want them writing the rules of trade because it won't level the playing field for American agriculture.
Am I correct that even if the United States doesn't act on the TPP, if enough of the rest of the trade partners were to act and approve it, that it would go into place regardless of what happens in the United States?
Well, it depends on the number of countries that approve it. I think in order for it to actually be effective, I think both Japan and the United States have to basically approve it. But here's the reality. If for some reason the United States decides not to, the Congress decides not to approve this, the other nations within TPP are free to have their own bilateral or multilateral agreement, or they may opt to work with China on the All-Asia Trade Agreement. All of those scenarios basically will not level the playing field for the United States. It will exclude the United States, and American agriculture will be at a disadvantage, not with a level playing field, but with a very uneven and uncompetitive situation. So it just doesn't make sense for American agriculture that we don't get this thing through this year.
Let's switch topics now. Is there a path forward for a federal GMO labeling law?
Well, this is a confusing process now. The failure of the Senate to pass a labeling bill at this point has provided an impetus for a number of individual companies to make decisions on their own to proceed to comply with Vermont law. And other states are now considering similar legislation, and I'm afraid we're going to have sort of a hodgepodge of rules and regulations. It's going to make it very difficult for processing companies to know precisely what to do and where to do it and how to do it. I still hold out hope that reason will prevail and that we'll see the wisdom and the efficiency of having a national standard. I do believe it's going to have to be mandatory. I think it's going to have to provide a series of options for the conveyance of information about GMOs, and I think it has to have sufficient time and a sufficient effort on the part of industry to communicate to consumers how they're going to be able to get this information, whether it's a smart label, a 1-800 number on PAC, how that it just kind of depends on what the legislation ultimately has to look like. But I'm hopeful that the Senate can get this passed.
You and President Obama, along with several other legislators, have just returned from Cuba. Do you suppose the embargo will be lifted this year?
Well, I'm not sure about the timing of it. I'm very confident that at some point in time the embargo will be lifted. You know, the reality is that we're doing everything we can to try to promote additional trade opportunities in Cuba, especially with agricultural products. Cuba imports 80% of their food. The U.S. in the past has been 50% of that market. Today we're probably 10 to 15%. We've lost market share because of the barriers that we've constructed to trade. We've made it a lot harder for the Cubans to do trade with agricultural products. Lifting the embargo would certainly make it easier for us. It would allow us to use the trade promotion programs at USDA. It would allow us to have a greater presence in the country. In the meantime, we're going to continue to do what we've started to do, which is to build a relationship with the Cuban people and with the Cuban government, so that when the embargo is lifted, we're in a position to move very quickly to regain that market share that we've lost.
Illinois Senior U.S. Senator Richard Durbin has suggested that trade from Cuba could involve organic products. Is it okay for them to come into the United States, and how does that work into the programs that the United States Department of Agriculture over the last 8 years have been trying to develop as it relates to the local food systems?
Well, you know, here's the thing. There's a tremendous demand for organic, right now, the U.S. doesn't have enough land dedicated to organic production to meet by itself the demand. So it's going to be important for us to have access to supply so that we keep the price of organics to a point where people can afford to purchase it if they choose to do so. I don't think it necessarily conflicts. I think it complements our local and regional food effort. That effort is across the board. It's not just organic. It's conventional agriculture as well. Products more available in farmers markets and food hubs and farm-to-school programs and things of that nature. So I don't think it necessarily conflicts. I do think it gives the Cubans an understanding that we see trade as a two-way street, which I think makes it, our efforts more credible to the Cubans. After all, it's been 60 years since we've had a relationship with these folks, and so we have to build that relationship, and it's very difficult to build a relationship if you structure it in a way that only benefits the U.S. and doesn't have any potential benefit for the Cubans.
During the address that you made to the Good Food Festival in Chicago, you mentioned both the local food system and food insecurity. I'm wondering how these two policy matters are related and if they're intertwined.
Well, local foods is a strategy for rebuilding a rural economy and providing an opportunity for smaller-sized operators to be profitable so that they can negotiate their own price for whatever it is they grow or raise. There is an opportunity, especially with local foods, to also use that effort to combat food insecurity, which is why we've basically allocated almost $29 million in 48 states with a strategy to combat food insecurity through a number of community food projects. It may be community gardens, it may be working collaboratively with community kitchens, it may be encouraging a greater attention to avoiding food waste and redirecting that potential food waste into available resources for people that are struggling financially. So it isn't necessarily inconsistent, and in fact it's part of, but by no means all of, our efforts to build a local food and regional food system. We've obviously extended the microloan program. We've extended the growing season through the High Tunnel House financing through NRCS. We've provided additional value-added producer grants for processing. We've improved the market infrastructure with investments in food hubs. And we're providing more information so that people can adequately price their goods, be able to find where markets might exist. And we've expanded risk management tools in addition to this combination of local and regional food and food insecurity issues.
The latest addition to that whole bevy of programs is the Local Food System Toolkit. How important do you suppose that might be to communities, to business leaders, to policymakers, to foundations as it relates to their investments in a local food entrepreneur, whether it be a producer or a business?
Well, look, if you want to convince a mayor, a city council, or any local government official, or if you want to convince an investor who's interested in investing in entrepreneurship, you've got to be able to show them the facts. You've got to be able to show them the numbers. You got to be able to tell them that local and regional food systems actually does financially work. And to be able to do that, we think this toolkit that was developed with Colorado State University will help make that economic case so that you'll have greater support politically and from a financial standpoint.
And finally, how important are the relationships with Colorado State, which developed the toolkit, with FAPRI, with Texas A&M, with the University of Illinois as it relates to FarmDoc and the development of the ARC and PLC tools, crop insurance tools? How important are those relationships to the United States Department of Agriculture?
Well, it's a critically important relationship. I just looked at a memo concerning the Zika virus from our researchers who are working collaboratively with a number of land-grant universities at trying to figure out how we might be able to solve this problem, not just in the U.S., but around the world. This is a very important relationship. It provides opportunities, obviously, for us to research. It provides information for us to make things easier from a technical assistance standpoint, from an extension standpoint. That relationship, I think, is critically important and one that the rest of the world is envious of. The land-grant university system was a very visionary thing that President Lincoln and folks in Congress in 1862 did in beginning the process of setting up a way of getting information out into the countryside.
Mr. Secretary, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you. Take care.
That was U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. We held our conversation Friday morning, the 25th day of March, 2016. That wraps up this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. There were some technical difficulties with the recording of the program. However, you may visit our website now at willag.org. Posted there, you'll find the all-day Agricultural Outlook audio. It's willag.org. I'm Yuhovai Extension's Todd Gleason. Thanks for listening.